medical department, only two go to the bench, and we are more than a dozen.
You don't train, you only recover. That's a situation.
Preparation, hard work, confidence in overcoming those difficult moments.
Today we're still outside Liverpool and we are going to the first part of the medical test.
Welcome to this Football Medicine and Performance podcast. I'm Elle Trezise, a member of the FMPA education team and your host for this episode. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Mr. Andy Williams. Mr. Williams is a knee surgeon who has worked with many professional athletes, including Premier League football players and Premiership rugby players. He completed his medical training at King's College Hospital in London before completing orthopaedic training at the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital in Stanmore, after which he undertook a fellowship in Australia, where he gained some of his first experiences in sports-related surgery. His expertise now lies in sports-related knee injuries and knee ligament issues. He undertakes approximately 100 anterior cruciate ligament reconstructions every year. 90% of his work is with professional athletes. He is also a prize-winning researcher of knee-related issues. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, what a great pleasure. Thank you. And thanks for such a flattering introduction.
Oh, it's great to have you on board. And in this episode, we're going to discuss anterior cruciate ligament surgery for elite footballers. So already provided a bit of an introduction there, but in your own words, please tell us about your journey to date and particularly what led you becoming an orthopaedic surgeon for elite athletes.
So the journey is ever increasing in length, unfortunately, because I'm getting older, but I still love what I do. And I think my fascination in surgery and medicine really commenced as a kid, just as a concept about what surgeons would do. I remember my dad had one of his staff was nicknamed surgeon because he kept cutting himself. So I asked my dad what a surgeon was, and when he explained, I found that a really incredible concept. And so from a young age, I was interested, but the assumption at that time was I was going to inherit the building company and be a builder. But about age 15, it was suggested I might do medicine, and my parents and myself thought that was a good thing to do. And as a result, I had my stars lined up in terms of which exams to take, what to study. And luckily, bit by bit, I achieved those goals. And then after school, went to King's to study, which was a fantastic experience. And at that time, I had no idea what I would do. And I remember being challenged by a friend of mine who asked me what I was going to do. And I said, I'd be a GP. He said, no, you won't. I was really insulted by it. I thought, how do you dare tell me what I'm going to do? But of course, the only doctor I'd ever met at that stage was a GP. And I assumed I'd go back home to Devon and be the village GP if possible. I think that's what my dad wanted, but it was never going to happen in hindsight. I fell in love with surgery and was lucky enough to get a first house job that involved orthopaedics and worked for a really lovely man, Michael Mowbray at Croydon. And Michael inspired me, really. He's a knee surgeon. It's no surprise I ended up doing what he did. I thought he was great. And I did some general surgery there and then came back to King's. In fact, did a professorial medical job because when I was a student, that seemed to be what I was good at. But my heart really wasn't in it. And so surgery was the way forward. And through that, so I sort of engineered my own training program as we did in those days. You get one job after another, and it was a pretty efficient way of being very well trained. So combination of general surgery, orthopedic surgery, plastics, neurosurgery and cardiothoracics before becoming an orthopedic registrar at the Royal National at Stanmore, where I fell under the spell of a number of amazing people who absolutely inspired me to continue and try and excel in that area. George Bentley, Rolf Birch, just exceptional people amongst a whole number of others whose I should mention their names, but I won't for brevity. But so there some incredible people there, made me full of that ambition and drive. And I went to Australia, which really was the most important year of my life. It was the first time I was aware that I was okay. The Australians made me realize I was all right. I wouldn't say good, but just to be thought that of "Is You're Right" meant the world to me and gave me incredible confidence. So when I returned to the UK, I was really tooled up to do the job. And that 1 year of a sports surgery experience was truly extraordinary, and it really set me up very nicely. And I don't think I'd got that experience 25 years ago in the UK at that time. Things have changed, obviously, but it was the place to go. And I was so grateful for the experience there. And then also grateful that I was made senior lecturer at Stanmore at the Royal National on return to the UK, which was like finishing school, if you like. And I always have the backup of Professor George Bentley to look after me and make sure I made the right decisions and got out of problems surgically. So that was wonderful. Before going to Chelsea Westminster, where I was for 15 years, I was an NHS consultant for 18 years. And I was able to really build my knee practice at Chelsea Westminster. And so about 7 years ago, I think it was, I left the Chelsea Westminster to concentrate on my research at Imperial College and also private practice. And I think things do have to give. And if you're involved in professional sport, as I am, to the level I am, it's now 90% of my practice. The demand on that service is great. And having an NHS practice at the same time is not entirely compatible with that at this level. So obviously I am very grateful to the NHS experience I had. I believe I worked very hard, and I hope I delivered a good return on the investment the NHS made in me. But it wasn't something that could continue. It wasn't, the two weren't compatible. But I hope I now return in many ways through my academic pursuits and teaching, which I do a lot of. Also my research, which helps guide treatment and management of patients, which I believe in some areas at least is to their benefit. So we've done some really cool stuff at Imperial College, particularly regarding ACL reconstruction and how to make it more reliable and the risk of re-rupture significantly less. And having done the experimentation, fine-tuned what actually is an old operation, a tenodesis on the lateral side of the knee, I'm delighted to have the data now and publish the data showing that in professional football, for example, were the best re-rupture rates in literature, about 6 to 8%. If you had a tenodesis in my hands, at least using a patellar tendon graft, putting it in the right place and adding a tenodesis is 2%. So that's been a really gratifying experience. So I guess that's where I am at today. 90% of my clinical work is sports, as I said. My research is clinical in terms of outcome studies on this very special group of people who really test what I do. And as a result, we can differentiate treatments. I'm sick and tired of so many papers that say that this treatment is not inferior to another treatment. If you operate on the general public, you often don't find out what's better. But if you operate on athletes, my God, they teach you what works and what doesn't work. So it's been a joy to do that, plus the basic science research is Imperial. And then on top of that is my clinical workload and lecturing, I guess. So that's my life at the moment. I hope that answers your question.
And it's really interesting to hear about your journey. Now, let's move on to talking a bit about the ACL and then also the surgery for repairing or reconstructing it. So to start off, could you tell us a bit about the ACL and what its functions are?
Yeah, so that's this short little bit of gristle has dominated my life, certainly my working life. And it turns out it's really, really important. And like all ligaments, it has a structural function in tethering two bones together and helping guide motion of the knee joint. But also because the nerve endings in it has a very important proprioceptive function as well. And so the tension within the ligament is picked up by sensors, which send messages to the brain, and the brain then fine-tunes the neuromuscular control of the limb, which is probably the most important stabilizer of a joint rather than the static function of holding the two bones together. And the static function, due to the orientation of the ligament, which passes from the femur distally in an anterior direction, stops anterior translation of the tibia, but in fact predominantly stops anterior translation of a lateral tibia as long as the medial meniscus is intact. But also with its obliquity in the coronal plane, it controls axial rotation, it controls internal rotation. So in sports involving a change of direction, it's really, really important. And needless to say, most of the time when we're walking around, the ligament isn't that tight. It's got a little bit of give in it, and it's really a proprioceptive organ. But the only time it takes up the slack is during injury or being in a position of extreme rotation, and usually in sport. And so the ligament is in the news a lot at the moment because of the increasing awareness of it and its injury, particularly with change of direction sports, so-called pivoting sports such as football, rugby, etc. But also jump land sports, it's very important. And netball is almost an ACL disease. The rule that you can only take one step after you catch the ball often means the players are off balance. And so if they're able to take a second or a third step, we may see less ruptures in netballers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And once injured, symptoms can include pain, immediate swelling, and a pop sound or sensation, as many of our listeners will know. But there's more than one way, of course, to injure the ACL. So could you briefly explain for us the different mechanisms?
Yeah. So the history is classic in most people, and it's a tragedy that still probably the majority of ACL ruptures don't have a diagnosis made for some time. They present to A&E, they have an x-ray, which usually looks normal, doesn't always, but usually it's normal. And they meet one of the most junior people in the hospital who is unable to detect the diagnosis, which is a pity because patients sometimes fall through the net and have instability episodes, which cause damage to the joint. And it really is frustrating that we don't seem to be able to improve the pickup rates. And I know certain studies describe that the pickup rate was around 50-50, and it doesn't seem to have changed 20 years later. So the history is absolutely classic. It's usually a change of direction during sport that goes wrong. Maybe the foot got caught in the ground, or they slipped a little bit. And that change of direction usually, interestingly, involves some external rotation, a bit of valgus applied to the knee. When we look at MRI scans, there's a pattern of bone bruising that can only occur with the lateral femur falling off the back of the lateral tibia. And in fact, that's an internal rotation phenomenon. So I have to say, we still haven't really worked out the mechanism of injury. It occurs during axial rotation, internal or external rotation, most commonly. The other mode of injury is due to hyperextension, in which the ACL comes up against the anterior surface of the intercondylar notch and it gets guillotined in that way. That's much less common, but it does occur. Following the injury, as you said earlier, probably 75% of patients will feel a pop or a snap in the knee, and they're usually aware of lateral pain. And the lateral pain is because there's effectively a dislocation, if you like, of the lateral part of the tibiofemoral joint. Truly, it's a subluxation of the knee, but the lateral femur falls off the back of the lateral tibia. And so patients you often see on videos grab their lateral side of the knee. And then with the ligament being vascular, rapid swelling to some degree, sometimes it's minor, sometimes not, but there'll be some swelling in around 90% of cases within 1 to 2 hours of injury. And so that is the classic story when somebody presents to A&E, for example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you talked a little bit about some of the other structures that could be being damaged and what's happening to them during injury. But typically, what do you tend to see in terms of the other structures damaged at the same time as the ACL?
Yeah, that's a really important question. A truly isolated ACL rupture is almost non-existent. For the ACL to rupture, as I mentioned earlier, the femur has to sublux off the back of the lateral tibia. And in that motion, the lateral meniscus gets drawn posteriorly, and a meniscus tear in the lateral meniscus is significantly more common than the medial meniscus, but the posterior horn of the medial meniscus, the posterior third, has a very important stabilizing function. It's almost like a wheel chock under the medial femoral condyle. And we're increasingly aware of peripheral meniscocapsular separations of the meniscus from the capsule on the medial side as well. So those meniscus injuries are very common. The posterior root of the lateral meniscus can sometimes avulse, and that's a classic association with ACL injury. But due to the torsional twist on the knee, the medial ligaments and the posterolateral structures are frequently injured as well. My current research obsession, I think it'd be fair to say, is the deep MCL. The superficial MCL restricts valgus, and in early flexion, the most important restraint to external rotation is, in fact, not the superficial MCL, which was previously thought to be the case, but the deep MCL. And if you look at an MRI scan, we published a study that about three quarters will have edema in the deep MCL due to associated with an ACL rupture, in a case that was supposedly an isolated ACL rupture. And increasingly, I'm adding MCL surgery to protect my ACL grafts.
Mm-hmm, okay. And there are both, of course, surgical and non-surgical treatment options for ACL injuries. And in this episode, we're focusing on the surgical treatment options. But when would surgery be recommended over non-surgical management? And how soon after injury would you typically do the surgery?
So the first very important statement is not every ACL rupture needs an operation. And the worst thing somebody can have is a bad operation. And unfortunately, that still occurs, which is depressing. And the variability of surgery is one of the biggest challenges in modern medicine. Obviously, there are some great people out there who do a great job repeatedly, but there are others who seem to be less able to do so. And I think delivering consistency in surgery is something we have to work out as a surgical community to deliver. So what I would say is most young, active people do best to have a good ACL reconstruction, choosing my words extremely carefully, because, as I say, bad surgery or a surgery that has significant complication, which of course does occur even with good surgery, will leave a patient worse off than they would have been without surgery. But the risk-benefit analysis for young, active people, obviously I'm biased, I'm a surgeon, but I strongly believe that most young people do well to have a good ACL reconstruction for two reasons. One is to allow them to enjoy life and not have to worry about an unstable knee. And two, because I do genuinely believe it protects the joint. I know that's a controversial view, and if you look at the literature, you can argue against that. But I think the literature is increasingly strong to show that a good ACL reconstruction reduces subsequent meniscal pathology. And as night follows day, if you lose meniscal function, you get osteoarthritis. And I think we're starting to get data that will prove that. On the other hand, I do see patients who come through who've had a long period of non-operative treatment, and their knee is stepwise deteriorated, whilst some doctor is usually, or a physio, has presided over episodes of instability. So non-operative treatment is fine as long as the patient doesn't have instability. And that can be occult instability, with which the patient's not aware, and that's the big problem. So if a patient falls over, they'll seek help and I can fix them and everyone's happy. But if they don't keep falling over and they think their knee is all right, unwittingly they can damage the knee progressively to pretty bad state. And every year I deal with people who really miss the boat, and we can help them, but they never get a good result because they've got osteoarthritis, and all I'm doing is putting the brakes on it. And they're in for a series of operations for the rest of their life. An ACL rupture is a very potentially life-changing injury in the long term. And most people who have a good ACL reconstruction do very well. And I'm now seeing my patients 25 years out. They have a new injury, not old. And it's very pleasing to see on their MRI scans, they got little or no osteoarthritis in the majority of cases. So I do strongly believe this is a good operation. I admit it's hard to prove the protective effect for joint surface, but I think the evidence now for protection of menisci is overwhelming, actually. And the worst thing is having a patient having recurrent instability. So the deal is, if you go for non-operative treatment, you need to be really motivated to keep your neuromuscular control up with a maintenance program of rehab exercises, focusing on trunk, pelvis, and balance drills. You've got to keep that up for the rest of your life. And the patient has to be educated that they should not put up with anything the second best. And in particular, a feeling of insecurity equals instability. And the presence of any swelling is bad news. So they would be well advised to get their knees fixed if those things happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And a little bit of a spoiler in the bio I was reading at the beginning for you, but do you prefer repair or reconstruction of the ACL and why?
So repair of the ACL is something which was dealt with years and years ago, and the results were awful. And we were taught that the ACL wouldn't heal. And the reason it wouldn't heal is because synovial fluid doesn't let the blood clot. Whereas if you have an extra articular ligament injury, the blood between the ends of the broken fibers will set and glue. It's nature's glue fiber in the course. But the reality is ACLs do heal and can heal. And sometimes we'll examine a patient acutely and they've got a loose knee, and a month or two later when they come for surgery, they've actually tightened up. But if they've still got a positive pivot shift, that means that even though the ACL may have healed, it's not functioning. So we've got to be very careful and differentiate healing. And there's a lot of interest in non-operative treatment at the moment and also repair at the moment. And there's a recent British Journal of Sports Medicine publication on a bracing technique from Sydney, Australia, the so-called cross technique. And the MRI scans show healing. And I think it's genuine. But the problem is an MRI scan that looks favorable doesn't equal a stable knee. And so first of all, you have to be very, very careful that all that glitters isn't gold. And so just because the ACL looks like it's joined up doesn't mean to say it's actually working unless it's joined up to the femur in the right position. And the problem with repair is, first of all, we don't have enough data to know whether it works or not. So in elite sport, you can attend to do an operation that you know works, and that's a reconstruction. And what I wouldn't be prepared to do is effectively an experiment without data. So if the data is there and proves to me that ACL repair is reliable, then I would do it. Truth is, I do probably do between 5 and 8 ACL repairs a year. They're usually a clean avulsion off the tibia, whereas in youngsters, often you get a bone fragment. You don't always. And those do extremely well. The popularity of ACL repair is really in cases of ACL injury that are close to the bone on the femur. And there are now arthroscopic techniques. It means that the surgery is less invasive and it's suddenly become very attractive. The problem is that with the techniques concerned, often there's a crimping of the ACL, which therefore shortens. And therefore you can't actually get the ACL back up deep in the intercondylar notch where it should be. And I suspect that quite a few of the repairs are non-anatomic, and so their function is compromised. Now, some of the enthusiasts, that sounds like an insulting term, but some of those who are popularizing ACL repair use a phrase that it burns no bridges, quote unquote. Well, I think that's a really irresponsible phrase, because if a poor patient's had an ACL repair, they may be unaware that the ACL is not functioning. And they can actually end up having a lot of damage before the penny drops and they get a reconstruction. So I'm sorry to say to the surgeons who promote ACL repair that it, like any operation, you can never say it doesn't burn bridges. It's a lovely concept, but it just isn't true. So whatever we do should fix the knee, and we should have a high degree of success with it. And at the moment, we just don't have the data on repair. And I don't believe it's as reliable as reconstruction. So for my athletes, I would stick with reconstruction.
Okay, thank you very much for explaining that. So it's key to have a graft to reconstruct the ACL, and it can be sourced from multiple places, such as the hamstring, tendon, quadricep tendon, and patella tendon. So where do you personally prefer grafts to be sourced from and why?
So I've got a very strong preference for autograft, i.e. the patient's own tissue. Certainly, some surgeons are considering using allograft, i.e. donated tendon from cadavers, just in the same way you donate a kidney or other organ tendon that can be harvested for the purpose of reconstruction. But the re-rupture rates are very much higher. And in young patients, probably around 5 to 7 times as high as autograft. Synthetic ligaments were tried in the past, and they do not do well within the knee joint, although they definitely have a place in extra-articular ligaments, such as the medial collateral ligaments. And I have published very good results on using the synthetics there. But my strong preference for the ACL is to use autograft. And I vary my graft according to the person's sport and their lifestyle, etc. So for most people, general population people, hamstring grafts work extremely well. They recover very easily from the harvest of a hamstring and have very good results. But the truth is their re-rupture rate is a little higher than patellar tendon in particular. And it, certainly from my data that we published a couple of years ago, the re-rupture rate of a hamstring graft placed in the right position, which is a so-called antromedial bundle position of the femoral attachment ACL, is around 10% with hamstring and around 7% with patellar tendon. But as I mentioned earlier, if you add a tenodesis, this lateral procedure, which tightens the IT band up, leaving it attached to the tibia and attaching to the distal femur, if you add that, that brings the re-rupture rate down to 2% if you're using patellar tendon graft. So in professional football, for some reason, patellar tendon has a significantly lower re-rupture rate. And it is very obviously the best graft. It has a bit of bone at each end. It has a natural connection of a soft tissue to the bone, and it will heal extremely rapidly. But you could argue the price of it is a little more in that it's more painful for the patient, and the rehab is a little more difficult. And obviously with pro athletes, I'm blessed to have people who are really tough, really hard people, because they play sport and they do pain. And so, and they have great physio at the clubs and great rehab and direction from their medical team. So I'm blessed and I can get away with doing big operations that hurt on these people. But for my standard patients, I've used hamstrings. Interestingly, in professional rugby, I've tended to use hamstring. The reason for that is cultural, really. I went to Australia and was taught how to do hamstring ACL reconstruction. And the Australian rugby players tend to get hamstring grafts. In New Zealand, they get patellar tendon. Again, that's cultural because the big name surgeon there, Barry Titchens, who did all the All Blacks, you know, best team in the world. So you can't knock a patellar tendon graft in rugby in that setting. But you'd think the re-rupture rate in rugby would be greater. It's such a violent sport. But actually, it's greater in football. So hamstring re-rupture rates are low in rugby, particularly when a tenodesis is added. Now, the new kid on the block, if you like, is quad tendon. And quadriceps tendon grafts are really gaining popularity, particularly in North America and in Victoria in Australia. But what I would say is we don't yet have concrete data showing efficacy and satisfactory re-rupture rates. So we have to just watch that space carefully. I think that my ideal patient for a quad tendon graft is a person who kneels. So maybe a floor worker, carpet layer, that sort of person, or a judo fighter who has to be on their knees and has to maintain hamstring power, but also dancers. And I've routinely been using them in dancers for some time. And certainly the results have been very good. And I believe the recovery is easier than with a patellar tendon by some degree. But of course, patellar tendon surgeries, or graft harvest, I should say, is getting better and better. And the operation today is so much less traumatic than it was when I learned it 30 years ago.
Thank you for explaining that. And it's so interesting how, you know, the source of the tendon depends a lot on the patient, actually, and how you're telling it to the patient.
Yeah, so I think customizing surgery is really the way to go. And to get great results from an operation, you have to fine tune. And you don't just do the same operation every time. You've really got to think. And I know orthopedic surgeons have got a reputation for often not thinking. I was taught that you had to have the strength of an ox and half the brain. But I promise you that's not true. And I promise you I think a lot before I operate on people. I have a ritual. The night before every surgery, you go through all the notes, all the imaging, and really think about that case. And the fine-tuning is what makes a difference. You don't win a football match, a rugby match, without doing tactics and thinking about the oppo and nailing it. And you don't just turn up and do surgery. You shouldn't. But occasionally, I think some people might do that. But it's all about planning. And there's no excuse in orthopedic surgery, certainly not knee surgery, to have a surprise. There are one or two things that do happen, such as chondral lesions, which aren't visible on MRI. But, you know, you should know that there's a peripheral meniscus lesion, there's a root lesion of the lateral meniscus, because you've done the due diligence and you've got a surgical plan to fix all the lesions. And if you don't do that, the ACL graft takes more stress and it's more likely to fail. And so I think we're in an era now, we've worked out where to put the graft. There's been huge debate over a long period. And there was a period where, understandably, there was popularity placing the graft in the center of the so-called footprint on the femur of the ACL insertion. But actually, the results were not good. And my re-rupture rates in professional football doubled. And that was a bad period for me. So I went back to the original antromedial bundle position in the knee. So I think we know where to put the graft now. We have to accept there are some limitations with grafts, but we've learned that we also need to deal with the peripheral lesions, the collateral damage, if you like. If you leave a loose MCL, or if you leave a loose LCL or a loose meniscus tear, unstable meniscus tear, that ACL will have to work harder and is more likely to fail. So we're in an era now of fine tuning. That demands extra bits to the operation. My ACLs now take a lot longer than they used to. My poor anaesthetist has to suffer that, but my results are so much better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's brilliant. And
You did ask me a question earlier on about when to do ACL surgery, and I forgot to answer it. I was so long-winded in my answer on something else. But the timing of an ACL reconstruction is important, and the terrible error is to do it too soon. And if you add surgical trauma, and surgery is an injury, to the original injury trauma, the knee is at great risk of being excessively inflamed and scarring up and losing range of motion. The most common complication of ACL reconstruction is loss of terminal extension. And if you operate on an angry knee as a surgeon, you're asking for trouble. And so there are very few indications for early surgery. The only one really is in the context of an isolated ACL rupture, is a locked bucket handle tear of meniscus. And you want to get in and deal with that meniscus as soon as possible. Usually I would then delay the ACL reconstruction for a month or two until the knee was quiet. But the key is that surgery is not undertaken until the knee is quiet. Now, obviously in professional sport, particularly professional football, a footballer may be earning an immense amount of money every week. The pressure from everybody to get on and do the operation is massive. But I think I've been around the business long enough, most clubs listen to me and also players. And sometimes it's best to wait a few weeks until the knee is settled. There are other knees, though. I've operated today on a guy who did it at the weekend. So it's Wednesday and he did this four days ago. But his knee is quiet. He walked in without crutches. He's got full active and passive extension, a small effusion, and his knee was ready. So we could crack on with it. But there are other guys I'll make wait 12 weeks sometimes. I mean, that's rare. And we used to always wait a minimum of 3 weeks, but that's not necessary. And many players can get on with it earlier. My average time is about 2 weeks, which is earlier than it used to be. But particularly with the general population, there is no rush. And when I see somebody with a fixed flexion deformity and a surgeon asking me to sort it out, I look back at the history and it's almost always the problem is that the operation was done too soon.
Okay. So tell us a bit about the importance of post-op physiotherapy and how you work with team physios, doctors, and other club staff to optimize outcomes for your patients.
Well, the first thing is that this is a team game, and all of us in our various specialities bring something different to the table. And so to get a really good result from an operation, I need the help of a number of people who basically make me look good. And over the decades of me doing surgery on professional athletes, in fact, 25 years now, I've been blessed to have some amazing people, doctors and physios, who've really made me look all right, which is why I'm still in business, I think. There are one or two make me look bad, and it's not universally good, but in professional sport, usually I'm blessed to have that expertise that not everybody has access to. And so it's very, very important that I communicate properly and we understand what's going on and all of us have questions answered and we optimize treatment. Now, the smart ass answer about rehab is it starts before the operation. And for me to do an ACL reconstruction, I want the knee to have full active as well as passive extension. And we used to think of passive being good enough. It's not. You really want a good quad contraction. And I want the knee quiet. In other words, little swelling. They need to be bending to at least 100 degrees or so comfortably, and the knee just isn't as angry as it was. So that's when I will do the surgery. And then immediately post-operatively, the absolute drive is twofold. One, to get the knee quiet again after the surgical trauma, various icing devices. We tend to use something called a game ready a lot. Get the swelling down, and that allows the quadriceps to start firing again, and get extensions. The second thing, which is equally important, is to get full extension as soon as possible. And if you don't get extension as soon as possible, scar builds up on the anterior surface of the ACL graft, and then you'll never get straight. And then the only answer is surgical solution, which is regrettable. If the knee won't bend, usually all I need to do is manipulate it under anesthetic. But if it won't come straight, manipulation doesn't work. And the only answer is to clear out the scar at the front of the knee, usually in the fat pad and on the anterior graft, which is a so-called Cyclops lesion, clear that out, and sometimes do a posterior capsular release. I used to do that through an immediate post-remedial incision, going right across the back of the knee, stripping the capsule off the bone. These days, quite frequently, I'm able to do that arthroscopically. So I want the physiotherapy and the rehab team to first of all understand the importance of those various goals, but then to execute the treatment that's required. And passive stretches, so-called prone hangs, where the knee is on the edge of a couch with the leg below and foot hanging off it, are good ways of using gravity. The problem with a heel prop, where you put your heel up on something watching TV, is within 2 seconds the limb tends to externally rotate and you lose the gravitational effect. If you want to do a heel prop, then you need to get the foot vertical, pointing upwards. But all of the passive methods really are very much less important than active extension. So you need to get the quad firing ASAP, and the quad's grossly inhibited by swelling and pain. So pain control is really important, and we need to nail that. And also to reduce swelling. If you've got a big effusion, you can't contract your quad, then you have a weak quad, which means when you walk, you have less shock absorbency and you don't drive the knee straight. So all these things come together and work together. So I want to get the quadriceps working now. One of the tricks is when you ask patients to straighten their knee, that you'll see them lift their buttock off the bed. And what they're doing is extending the hip with gluteal contraction, and they're using the bed to passively extend the knee. That's not good enough. And sometimes the brain is brilliant at compromise. So if you see that happening, I actually want the patient to lift the heel off the bed with a straight leg lift, very slowly elevate the foot into dorsiflexion, try and get the quad to contract. And if it doesn't happen to contract, then ask the patient to slowly lift the heel off the bed. And that will stop the glutes working and extending the hip, because you want to flex the hip a bit. And the only way of doing that is get your quad to work. So sometimes an old-fashioned straight leg lift is actually quite important. The other aspect to reduce the fat pad contribution to stiffness is low mobility. And so patellar mobilizations are very important as well.
Okay, brilliant. And based on your experience, how important is psychology and communication for improving patient outcomes?
Psychology, I suspect, is 95% of my business. I'm a bit of an amateur psychologist, I guess, but showing empathy when you first meet a patient is critical. And if they're a professional athlete, they need to know that you get it, and you need to demonstrate that you realize how important this is for them and understand how devastating it is for them. Because they go through a classic grief-type psychological reaction, and you have to take them through that journey. And if an athlete loses hope early on, it's a disaster. And it's essential that I communicate in a very positive way, even if the injury is awful. And if you've got their ACLs and their ACLs, as you know, but if you've got a big chunk out of your joint surface, that may be a career-ending injury. And whilst I will never lie, and I always get that truth out in the first consultation, I will also explain what we're going to do about this bad injury. And whilst I'll say, look, this could be career ending, however, there is treatment for this problem. And I've had this experience many times before, and we've been totally successful in returning athletes to the highest levels of play despite this. And so being positive is very important. You mustn't lie, of course. and the patient, the player needs to know the situation in full. But the truth is, we get people back, particularly with excellent physio and amazing people, i.e. the athletes themselves, that you're, as a surgeon, astonished they got back from. So you shouldn't be giving up just now. It's not time to chuck the towel in. So I hope I generate a very positive atmosphere, but also a very honest one and a very empathic one. And that's the beginning. And then through the journey, the players will have issues. And I think about 10% of my ACLs have a snag along the way that needs an arthroscopy. And you need to explain what's going on and be able to convey confidence that all will be well. But obviously, if it's a very serious problem and you know that they can't recover, you've got to cut your losses and say it. But over the years, I've encountered all sorts of problems. Usually it's pain from the fat pad or limited motion, as you mentioned. And over the years, you learn the solutions to these. There are moments when I convey my confidence, although inside I'm thinking, Christ, I'm not sure I'll be able to fix this one. But you have to have a plan, and you have to be brave, and you have to address the problem, take it seriously and fix it. And with the athletes' help, and they are amazing people, the physio's help and the team physician's help, then we usually get the result.
Okay, and lastly, please talk us through your approach to the following scenario. An athlete comes to you and they've had an ACL reconstruction, but they've now suffered a re-injury.
So it would be a lie to say I've never had this scenario from my own surgery. I'm delighted, obviously, to tell you that the majority of such cases have had surgery with other people, but it's a devastating situation for the poor athlete because they've been through the rehab program, they've worked like hell, and usually when there's a re-rupture, it occurs in the first 6 to 12 months after return to play, so they almost get back-to-back injuries, so it's awful. And they may be out of contract this time around, which is really difficult. And so, as I mentioned earlier, you've got to show absolute empathy, and you've got to explain what has happened, perhaps why it's happened. And unfortunately, we do see cases that where the operation wasn't a good operation initially, and the technical error from the surgery has led to it. But it's a very bad thing to dwell on that. It creates a lot of negative psychology. But I'll explain what's happened, why it's happened, if I know. And often there is something called bad luck, which is a commodity in professional sport, doesn't seem to exist in most people's opinions. But I promise you, there is bad luck. And you have to offer a solution because the devastation of the re-injury is real and big. And the athlete needs to know what you're going to do to get them back into what they love doing, and ideally at the level that they are happy with. So thankfully, modern surgery is very good. And I've published a series of revision ACL reconstructions in professional athletes with very high return to play rates. In fact, 90%. Now, with a primary ACL reconstruction, the return to play rate overall is just over 90%. Although in young athletes, it's as high as 98%, which is again. But with revisions, you know, you wouldn't get odds at the bookies that good. So although it's a devastating blow, with modern redo revision surgery, most of my players will get back to the same level. So it's not all over. And you have to encourage the right psychology, as you mentioned earlier on, to get the athlete through that difficult time.
Okay, well, that's brilliant. Thank you. And unfortunately, we need to end there, but I found that really interesting. I'm sure the listeners have got a lot out of it as well. So thank you so much for giving up your time and for sharing your expertise with us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to the FMPA podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or SoundCloud. Alternatively, please check out the podcast section of the FMPA website. Links to any research papers or resources mentioned will be provided in the description of this podcast episode. Thank you for listening to the Football Medicine and Performance Podcast. Have a great day.